Welcome to Good Heavens, a podcast about how the heavens declare the glory of God.
Those thousands of excited folks you just heard were not cheering for Taylor Swift or the Kansas City Chiefs or any other earthly or man-made spectacle. They were all gathered under the cloud-covered skies of the Homestead National Monument in southeast Nebraska in August of 2017. Their eyes and cameras lifted toward the heavens, hoping, praying, and chanting for the clouds to part, so that they might have a glimpse of the spectacular Great American Total Eclipse of 2017. While clouds obscured most of the totality, for a few brief moments, the clouds actually parted, and as you heard, the crowd was in awe. I kind of think that's what church ought to sound like. The awestruck cheers of the crowd also reminds me of the passage in the 15th chapter of the book of Revelation, where those who overcame the beast, his number, and image, quote, sang the song of Moses, the bondservant of God, and the song of the Lamb, saying, Great and marvelous are thy works, O Lord, the Almighty. Righteous and true are thy ways, thou King of the nations. Who will not fear, O Lord, and glorify thy name? For thou alone art holy, for all the nations will come and worship before thee, for thy righteous acts have been revealed. End quote. The heavens do indeed declare the glory of God, and we cannot help but be caught up by such a declaration with tears and cheering and celebration. Though I personally have never seen a total eclipse, I am told by those who have seen them that they are an absolutely mesmerizing and surreal experience. Eclipse chaser Sergei Brunier described his first total eclipse he witnessed from the Hawaiian Observatory, high atop the peak of the Mauna Kea volcano, this way. Quote, The sight is so staggering, so ethereal, and so enchanting that tears come to everyone's eyes. It's not really night. A soft twilight bathes the Mauna Kea volcano. Along the ridge, the silvery domes, like ghostly silhouettes of a temple of the heavens, stand rigidly beneath the moon. The solar corona, which spreads its diaphanous silken veil around the dark pit that is the moon, glows with an otherworldly light. It is a perfect moment, end quote.
Thank you.
That quote can be found in the opening chapter of Guillermo Gonzalez's and J.W. Richards' 2004 book, The Privileged Planet, How Our Place in the Cosmos is Designed for Discovery. And you are in for a very special treat on the broadcast today, for our guest this week is none other than astronomer and fellow at the Discovery Institute in Seattle, Washington, Dr. Guillermo Gonzalez himself, who took time out of his busy schedule to chat with us about the upcoming total eclipse happening over a swath of the United States on April 8th to include the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. That's correct. In the event you have not yet heard, most of the Dallas-Fort Worth area will be directly in the path of totality on the early afternoon of April 8th for a little over 4 minutes. That means the moon's shadow will be exactly traversing directly over us here in DFW. I am sure, even if the weather is a bit cloudy as it was in Nebraska 7 years ago, that there will still be cheering. It will be my first ever total eclipse, and if you're in the DFW Metroplex, plan to visit Waxahachie, Texas, which will be more or less right smack dab in the middle of the moon's shadow. You can see the notes of this episode for how you can attend the Discovery Institute event with Guillermo and Jay in Waxahachie on April 8th. Tickets for the event are only $8. Wayne and I plan to be there as well. So come and join us live and in person and see what it's like to be in the shadow of the moon this upcoming April 8th. Also, be sure to check out Guillermo's free article about the eclipse for the internet magazine Salvo. A link to the article can be found in the notes of this episode. If you were to peruse information about the eclipse online or look through any contemporary book on astronomy about eclipses, you are bound to read at some point that the alignments of the Earth, Moon, and Sun, the sheer beauty of the heavenly spectacle, is all just a fluke, a chance coincidence. But how many coincidences must there be before one accepts the possibility of intelligent design? Is it just a coincidence that we have an atmosphere on Earth which enables us to breathe and cheer, and one through which we can actually see such a stunning event? Is it just a mere coincidence that the Sun is about 400 times larger than the Moon, but that the Sun is also just about 400 times further away from Earth than the Moon, so that the disks of both the Sun and the Moon appear to be identical in size in the sky? Is it just a coincidence that the Sun and Moon are two of the most nearly perfectly spherical entities in the solar system? Is it just a coincidence that eclipses happen so regularly that we can predict where and when they will occur with pinpoint accuracy? Is it just a coincidence that the mathematics so beautifully describes and corresponds to what we observe in the heavens? Is it just a coincidence that the Sun, Moon, and stars and the rest of the cosmos are intelligible to us? For my 2 denarii, the answer to all of the above is a resounding no way. I firmly believe eclipses, like everything else in the heavens, declare the glory of God in a silent, tacit speech, which unceasingly pours forth knowledge day and night. And when we fully behold such declarations, we cannot help but break out in tears and cheering and celebration. We here at Good Heavens hope you enjoy this special Great American Eclipse 2024 preview episode with our very special guest this week, astronomer Dr. Guillermo Gonzalez. As we begin the broadcast, I asked Guillermo if this was his second or third total eclipse he's seen in person, and I asked him about what people in the path of the totality can anticipate experiencing on April 8th. Here is Dr. Guillermo Gonzalez.
Actually, this will be my third.
Oh, wow.
So, yes, my first was in India in 1995, and my second was the Great American Eclipse of 2017.
Yes.
I went to Missouri for that one, and this one will be my third total eclipse. I've seen many partials, and a couple of annular eclipses, but this
okay.
will be my third total. Yep.
And you're coming to Waxahachie, Texas here in
That's right.
April, which I was looking at a really well-done graphic on YouTube of the total shadow of the moon going over the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex.
Yeah.
And Waxahachie is nearly dead center to where
exactly
the shadow is going to be. So it's going to be spectacular. Is there a spot for our Texas listeners? Is there a spot in Waxahachie, or is this city going to be filled with people from all over the planet? Where are you going specifically?
Well, it's specific. The Discovery Institute selected a location. It's a small college. I believe it's Assemblies of God. Don't quote me on that, but it's something. Yeah, it's Assemblies.
Okay.
College there. You can look it up and go to the Discovery Institute website to find out if you can still get tickets for it. We're going to have the event on that day, April 8th, out in the soccer field. And we'll be Jay Richards and I, Jay Richards, the co-author of The Privileged Planet, will be kind of interviewing each other and talking during the eclipse. So we'll be entertaining people as they view the eclipse. We'll be eclipse glasses that people can wear, those simple glasses you can even get at Walmart these days. I saw at Walmart the other day.
Yeah, yeah.
We had totality.
We had the annular eclipse this past fall.
In October.
In October, yeah. I was at the University of Texas at Arlington, and they were handing out glasses. And the crowd there was several hundred people there. And it was just fascinating to listen to people's reaction, to watch the daylight change so drastically, to see the crescent shadows on the ground through the leaves and everything.
Yeah.
So a lot of Texans, Guillermo, this is going to be the first time it's my first time seeing a total eclipse. Visually speaking, set us up. What's this going to look like? I mean, I know it's long. It's like double the length of the one in 2017. So what are we, are we looking at nighttime for about 5 minutes? What are we talking about here?
Not complete nighttime, but pretty dark. Dark enough to see the planets.
Wow.
One or two bright stars. So it's a very odd kind of lighting because you're in the middle of this shadow. And so in the distance around you, you can see a bright horizon. It's kind of brightish. So the illumination is very different. And as you noted during the annular eclipse, the illumination is very odd too. You feel kind of weird. It's not quite twilight. And if you stand under trees, you can see crescents. And if you're right in the path of the annularity for an annular eclipse, you can see little rings under the trees, little circles, which is fascinating. I wanted to go to Lost Maples State Park there last October, but I didn't get a chance to see the annular eclipse.
Yeah, I was able.
That's a beautiful park.
Oh, it
is. Right time of year.
Right, exactly. It's so beautiful. It was beautiful, perfect weather. I had eclipse glasses, and people were taking pictures with their cell phones through the eclipse glasses. And some people were pulling it off pretty well. It was pretty impressive to look at. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're going to be able to – is this – I was reading in your book the difference between two types of eclipses when we're talking about totality. There was the perfect eclipse. And what was the other one that you talked about?
So basically the kinds of – eclipse. So they're basically, just to give you a background for the listener on eclipses, there's partial eclipses. So if you're not in the path of totality during an eclipse, a solar eclipse, there's a very, very wide area of the Earth where you can see a partial eclipse. So the sun partially eclipsed. Then there's annular eclipse, where even if you're in the central path where the shadow is darkest, you don't see the sun's bright photosphere completely blocked out, right? Mm. And so it doesn't quite get dark enough to see any stars. So that's an annular eclipse. And it happens because the moon's a little bit farther away from the Earth in that part of the orbit for those eclipses, because your moon's orbit's a little eccentric, a little elliptical. And then total eclipses is when the moon is close enough to completely block the sun's bright photosphere for viewers within the path of totality, which is typically about 100 kilometers in width or so for the average eclipse. And so on the Earth, you know, the moon is almost on average exactly the same size as the sun in the sky. So for that reason and a couple of others, I call our solar eclipses viewed from Earth our total eclipses, perfect eclipses.
Hmm.
So that's the name I give to our particular eclipses from the Earth. But for several reasons, we get to enjoy the best solar eclipses in the solar system.
Yeah, I noticed you have a nice handy chart in Privileged Planet. There's only one other moon in our solar system, and it's potato-shaped. What is it?
Yes.
Prometheus?
It's around Saturn. Prometheus around Saturn. And it's like on the edge of the ring system. It's one of these shepherd moons. But because Saturn is so much more massive than the Earth, it just from Newton's law of gravity, that means the moon's going to orbit around much faster. And so not only is it not a round shape on the sky if you're viewing it from the cloud tops of Saturn, but it also zips by really quick. So the eclipses it produces are extremely short duration. The sun, of course, is much smaller from Saturn,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Very tiny. The Earth is the closest planet to the sun with the moon. And so we get to enjoy the largest angular size on the sky of the eclipse sun of any planet with moons in the solar system.
So there's the Earth is one out of hundreds of moons that we know about in the solar system now.
That's right.
We can see this because Prometheus, for all its alignment with Saturn and the sun, is a potato shaped. You're not even getting a circular shape.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you're not getting a very good eclipse to begin with. You know, the thing has to be aligned just right.
Yeah.
At that particular moment of the eclipse. And so the duration of the eclipses from there are like a second or less.
Right.
Very fleeting.
Right.
Ours are 7.5 minutes maximum.
That's awesome. Now you read, you go online, you read about this. It's the news is everywhere. I've got several astronomy books where, you know, astronomy, as you know, is dominated by the secular interpretation of everything. And as breathtaking as astronomers are struggling to come up with language, you cite Sergei, I forgot what his last name, a French astronomer, in your book about how
Serge Brunier,
yes. He was moved to tears by this experience.
They can't help but describe it in those words.
Yes.
The awe that they have towards this spectacular, beautiful event.
It tingles the spine and makes whatever hair you have left on your head stand up.
That's right. When I was in India, for example, in 1995, I was in a small village in northern India, and I joined an eclipse team, eclipse expedition of several other scientists. So we're in a roped-off compound where all the telescopes were. And then the locals were all around us, kind of viewing us like a performance. But as soon as totality, or the diamond ring effect, which is the last glint or hint of the bright photosphere of the sun before it gets covered up, and totality begins, it's the mark of the beginning of totality. People were just in awe. They're vocalizing their wonder and their awe, and they were applauding as if applauding a performance or a choreographer with a dance.
Right.
A group or something. And the scientists, too. I mean, the scientists were equally in awe and just in wonder, as well as the local villagers. So it doesn't matter what the level of education is. People are equally in awe of this beautiful event.
And when you go to NASA or some knowledgeable astronomer of a local planetarium, the phrase that keeps coming up is remarkable coincidence.
Right.
And I wonder how many things have to line up before you cross the line from coincidence to specific design.
Let's or conspiracy.
A conspiracy of some kind.
Let's
talk a little bit about I know I had just talked to Bill Dembski a couple of weeks ago.
Okay.
And had Steve on the program before, Steve Meyer. And you guys are dealing with a lot of probability arguments.
Yeah.
And this question is just, it's lost on the mind of secular science that the only thing that they have in their repertoire, they don't have a language except to say they concede remarkability, but then the best causality is just a fluke. And it just seems so a tragic aspect of
That's right.
of our times today, Guillermo.
That's right. Their toolbox doesn't include the explanatory tools they need to account for real design in the universe. If they could just concede for a moment that, okay, maybe there's a possibility of evidence of design in nature, then they could perhaps see this. But you know, many of them will not even concede there's even the possibility that you could detect evidence of design in nature. And so for those people, they will never see it because they refuse to admit it. Doesn't matter how much evidence is presented to them. So that's unfortunate. But yeah, that's all they can reach for is chance, just a lucky fluke. And this was the first chapter of The Privileged Planet because to us it was such an impressive example. But not only that, it was the first instance of this correlation between the habitability of a planet, or to put it simply, the correlation between life and discoverability or observability of some important aspect of nature. And so eclipses, it's not just a coincidence that the Earth is the only planet with life, the only planet with complex life or any kind of life in the solar system. And it's also the best place to view eclipses from. So that's another coincidence. So one of the coincidences is, well, it's the best place in the solar system to view eclipses. Okay, that's one. Another coincidence is that it's the most habitable place in the solar system, and it's the best place to view eclipses from. Okay. So does that mean anything? And we claim it does. We claim it's a part of a much broader pattern in the universe where the best places to live also offer the best opportunities for scientific discovery. And so so the eclipses, not only are they beautiful and awe-inspiring, but they've also led to scientific discoveries. And so we talk about Eddington's expedition in 1919.
Yes.
To go see a solar eclipse in South America and near Africa. And they were able to test Einstein's general theory of relativity and said that it was correctly predicting, in fact, the change positions of the stars in the sky that you can see during a solar eclipse, as opposed to Newton. And so that was a really important event in the history of science, because that was a very controversial theory at the time.
Right.
You know, how could you disagree with Newton? But he said, no, here's a way to test it. And at the time, with the technology available, it was really the only way to test his new theory. Of relativity, and it passed. And by the way, that was a special eclipse. It was the longest eclipse in over 500 years.
Longest
duration one. Yeah, and it was right near a star cluster in the sky called the Hyades, a bright star cluster. It's actually a naked eye star cluster.
The Hyades is the V in Taurus, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
Not including Aldebaran.
Right.
Bright background star. Yep. And so. That's important because you want lots of bright stars near the sun when it's an eclipse. So then you can have several stars to measure. So most of the time, the sun is not going to be near that many bright stars right near the sun during an eclipse. It's just this one, it happened to be right next to the Hyades at that time. And so it was tailor-made, you might say, that eclipse for that for that experiment. It was the best possible set of circumstances.
Yeah. Well, I have used a lot of times in engaging with skeptical friends of mine, I've often brought up your argument in terms of, and I think it seems to be unique to you in a sense that part of what seems like the telos or the design of the universe is that we have a perch, if you will, on Earth. We have a view of a large part of the rest of the cosmos, including Lagrange points where we can sit telescopes. Seems like it's not just habitable, but in terms of it's habitable and we can see everything else that's out there for the most part too.
That's right.
That's incredible.
Right. And there's one other person, just to correct you, one other person who has been saying this also is a philosopher, Robin Collins.
Oh, yeah.
At Messiah College. He wrote a chapter in a book on, I forget, 24 or so arguments for God. I think that's what it was called. And so he discusses there, we independently came up with this. He more from a theoretical angle in theoretical physics, arguing that, you know, the laws seem to be set up to be discoverable. They're relatively simple. I mean, the main laws of physics, like the law of gravity and electromagnetism and so on. So it seems that the world is set up at a kind of a deep level for it to be discovered, so its truths could be discovered. Not, you know, it's not always easy, but it could have been much more difficult. I mean, it could have been the chaos. It could have been that the laws were different in different parts of the universe at different times and so on. Mm. Things seem to be set up for them to be discovered.
It seems to me it's like it's not only discoverable, but every time somebody makes a discovery, I'm struck always by Bertrand Russell's praise of mathematics, how he, even as an atheist, concedes that there is beauty in the laws of physics. And Paul Dirac, the quirky physicist of the early 20th century, also, mathematics is beautiful. And it's so, like, we're not just observing a chance alignment of a glowing ball of gas, a hunk of rock, and then, you know, we can see through our atmosphere. That there's something extraordinarily beautiful and moving. It's like if the way it was set up to breathe, that we'd have to go to a symphony to get air, it would be a beautiful way of breathing to have to take in the violins and the cellos. And it seems like it's just the same kind of thing, Guillermo, that this isn't, we're just not discovering cold, hard facts. We're discovering something that is inherently beautiful and inspiring further discovery, right?
Yeah. Yes. And, you know, just a couple of other very, very familiar examples. I think these are my top three: solar eclipses, rainbows, and the starry heavens, the starry night sky.
Absolutely.
And I mean, people, of course, David in his psalm wrote about the starry heavens. Mm-hmm. They proclaim God's handiwork and reveal his glory. And other cultures, even pagan cultures, have written of, you know, from the classics about how the starry heavens really are, you know, evidence of the gods. It's moved people to believe in God in different cultures. Just the view of this. So there's something about it that it moves us to believe in a greater being and a greater mind that must be behind all this. I mean, why all this? You ask why. You need to look, go out in the night sky, away from city lights, moonless night. See the stars. I'm sure most people have been just struck in awe. Ask why this? Right. Why? I mean, this is way beyond what I need for my everyday survival needs.
Absolutely.
I mean,
it is.
To go pick an apple from a tree, I don't need to be able to see the stars or see these beautiful rainbows that appear after a rainstorm, and rainbows too. I mean, they've led to a scientific discovery. Mm-hmm. You know, a rainbow, what is it but just a spectrum of the sun?
Yeah,
you spread the colors of the sun out at an angle on the sky, and from trying to figure out how to reproduce them, chemists came up with spectroscopy, and so did astronomers. They applied it to the stars, and then they figured out what stars are made out of. Mm-hmm. Auguste Comte, the founder of positivism, once said that we will never know the temperatures or compositions of the stars. It's interesting that somebody, you know, with that kind of mindset, that kind of worldview, had the expectation that the world wouldn't be very measurable. But yet there's a way for us to figure out, to a rather high precision, the various properties of the stars without having to go stick a thermometer in them, literally.
Right, right.
We can do it by studying their light. And that those clues, you know, were there. Starting with a rainbow. And so it's kind of, in all three cases, something beautiful, something awe-inspiring, eclipses, rainbows, night sky, attracts us to look at those things. And as if, you know, God is saying, look over here, there's something important for you to learn and discover.
Yeah. You'd mentioned David. I know you briefly mentioned Psalm 19. I was thinking of Psalm 8, where David is saying, how majestic is your name in all the earth.
Oh, yeah.
Who have displayed your splendor above the heavens. And then he says, when I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained, to your point earlier, what is man that you take thought of him, and the son of man that you care for him? It's like it's built into the cosmos, Guillermo, that when we look at it, we instantly ask the question, where am I in all of this? Where am I in all of this? And it, the modern world, and I'm sure you know this, you follow it like I do, in a sense that you hear from modern popularizers of science, and I think Carl Sagan made this a big deal, that we're insignificant, pale blue dot.
Yeah.
We have, the sun is an unremarkable star. We're in an unremarkable galaxy in an unremarkable place in the universe, et cetera, et cetera. How can we intelligently dispel this when some of the best minds are telling us these things?
I when people say that we're an insignificant speck, you know, it's basically, you know, saying we're so small. And in a sense, it's true. We are small compared to the rest of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, a miner goes down and risks his life in a deep mine to dig up precious diamonds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a diamond in a rough, you know, tiny thing, but it's a precious jewel.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can think of it that way, too. So there are two ways of looking at it. But the other part of this is that if it is true that the world is designed for us to discover its truths, then there is something special about our place in the universe, because we're taking part in the outworking of a purpose. I'm not saying the purpose, I'm just saying a purpose. Don't know all the purposes of the universe, but that's one of them, it seems, to learn about the universe. So it's the same way that you might learn about a carpenter by studying his bookshelves or other things he's made, his cabinets.
Mm-hmm.
You can learn some certain aspects of the carpenter, even if you've never seen the carpenter. You learn about him by studying his works. In a similar way, we do that through science. And of course, Kepler and other founders of modern science believe this, that they were trying to discern or learn about the mind of God in certain ways by studying his creation. And that motivated them to do science.
Right. Well, let's briefly, with the time we have left, I wanted to talk a little bit about and inform our listeners about this fascinating thing called the Saros cycle. We are in Saros number 139. But this cycle was, I think, goes all the way back to the Babylonians. It's a period of time, what is it, 18 years, 11 months?
About.
And 8 hours,
something like that.
What is this, Guillermo? What is and how did we stumble across this?
So the Babylonians were from the tablets, the cuneiform tablets that we found, very careful observers of celestial goings on. They they followed the motions of the planets, the sun, the moon. They observed eclipses. We have records of a number of eclipses they observed. By the way, they only observed one total eclipse. One total eclipse passed over Babylon.
Wow.
It was in 136 BC, and they actually, there's a record of that in one of the surviving tablets.
Oh, wow.
That particular eclipse. They described seeing a couple of planets, and then it was correct. You know, from our simulations, we compare their descriptions, and we find that, in fact, they were correct. And so that was probably the best recorded total eclipse observation from ancient times.
Oh, wow.
That particular eclipse. So they're extremely careful observers and recorders of events. They discovered a number of cycles in the Saros cycle they knew about. So they were able to predict eclipses to some extent. Lunar eclipses in particular, those are easier to predict. So they got to the point where they knew these cycles and the periods of these cycles well enough to make a calendar based on the lunar solar system, so based on the Saros cycle. So the Saros cycle results from the fact that the plane of the moon's orbit, you can think of it intersecting the plane of the Earth's orbit around the sun. So the plane of the moon's orbit around the Earth forms a plane. You know, there's a plane as it orbits around. And then the Earth, you can say, it defines a plane as the Earth orbits around the sun. And these two planes will intersect and align. It's like two pieces of paper. If you could kind of see where they intersect, if they're coming together, they're going to intersect and align. That line is called the line of nodes. And so when the line of nodes points in the direction of the sun, then you can have a season of eclipses. And so that happens twice in each year, about 6 months apart. So you can. So right now we're having eclipses. The next moon is actually an eclipse. The next full moon coming up in just a few days. It's not going to be a very spectacular one. It's called a penumbral eclipse. You can barely tell it's happening. But then 2 weeks later, we get the solar eclipse. So you often have eclipses occurring like this in pairs during a couple of month period. And then 6 months later, you're going to have another eclipse season. But now these eclipse seasons don't happen at exactly the same calendar dates every year because the line of nodes is rotating in space. And so, and the time it takes for this line of nodes to completely do one rotation is about 18 years is one Saros cycle.
That's fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. So there's also the science behind just the predictability, what we're just talking about. How naturalism has no explanation for why we can predict these things at all. It's just a fluke. It's just an accident.
Nature is very mathematical. Yeah.
Yes, yes. And I love to get into the dialogue about where does the math come from? Let's talk about eclipses.
Right.
Where does the math come from? Did we discover this? Or if we invented it,
exactly.
Wow that it works, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. A lot of philosophers have noticed that. Also physicist Eugene Wigner,
yes,
famously.
Right.
Wrote about the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics in the natural sciences.
Mm-hmm. Well, Guillermo, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule and day to talk with us. Hopefully, I'm planning to come down to Waxahachie, so hopefully maybe I can at least say hi to you. And
sure,
I want to get the audio of people's reactions almost
as much as
I want to see what's going to happen.
If you can interview people, that'll be great.
Yeah, just getting people's reactions and things like that. So if you're in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, come on down to Waxahachie, not too far south from the DFW Metroplex. It's going to be basically center spot for totality here in Texas for what they're calling the Great American Eclipse. And final thoughts, Guillermo, on eclipses and design in the universe and God's glory. What do you think?
If you can at all make it to the path of totality somewhere in the eastern U.S. This April 8th, please try. This won't happen again for another 20 years in the U.S. And it's a world of difference, totality versus partial solar eclipse. You really need to observe the total solar eclipse and get the experience.
Thanks for tuning in to our very special broadcast on the eclipse this week. We hope you've been encouraged and stirred to consider more deeply how the heavens truly do declare the glory of God. And just a reminder to be sure to check out Guillermo's free article about the eclipse for the internet magazine Salvo. A link to the article can be found in the notes of this episode. Wayne and I hope to see you in Waxahachie, Texas, this April 8th. For Watchman Fellowship and Good Heavens, I'm Daniel Ray. Soli Deo Gloria.
The heavens are telling of the glory of God, and the skies proclaim His handiwork. This is Good Heavens, a podcast about the cosmos and the Christian faith.